Okay, just a reminder, we're in that eighth major section of Genesis that follows the creation week prologue, but the toledot of the generations of Isaac. And that began in Genesis chapter 25, verse 19, and it's going to extend through Genesis chapter 35. And the focus in this section, this generations of Isaac, is on going to be primarily on the son Jacob. Okay, not a lot about Isaac in this section, but a lot about what follows Isaac, who follows Isaac, again, his youngest son, Jacob. So in chapter 25, we looked at the birth of Isaac and Rebekah's twin sons, Esau and Jacob. Again, after 20 years of faithful prayer and patient waiting, Rebekah conceives and miraculously conceives. Then we saw the prophecy of, that the older will serve the younger. There's going to be enmity between these two, Esau and Jacob. And there's parental favoritism that comes into play, which sets the groundwork for future family strife and disunity and the husband and the wife working against each other. It's not like the ideal marriage situation here, although it started out good. If you remember from previous chapters, Isaac loved Rebekah. You know, that's the first time that it's really said husband loves his wife. So started out kind of good, but then declined after the birth of the kids. So again, Isaac loved Esau, and Rebekah loved Jacob. And then also in chapter 25, we saw Esau foolishly and wickedly barter away his birthright. Remember, the birthright's a key thing as we work through this section of Genesis. And again, the birthright belonged typically to the oldest son. And it was a double inheritance, and it would be the person who would become the leader of the clan after the death of the father. And in the case of Abraham and Isaac, and it's also the promised line, the line of promise, who the Messiah would come through. And Esau, the oldest son, would typically have gotten that birthright, but in the prophecy that God gave Rebekah in chapter 25, it's that the older would serve the younger. Basically, that birthright is prophetically reversed by God himself in prophecy to Rebekah. And then we see along those lines, in keeping with that, in chapter 25, at the end, Esau sells his birthright to his brother Isaac. To his brother Jacob. I got to keep the name straight here. So Esau barters away his birthright to Jacob for a bowl of soup. So I hope it was good soup. And again, Jacob kind of taken advantage of Esau's carnality there, but it was all done in the open, up front, and it was legal to do that. So that's what we saw. That's how chapter 25 ended. Then in chapter 26, we saw kind of that reaffirmation of the Abrahamic covenant. The Abrahamic covenant has been a key factor beginning in Genesis chapter 12. We've talked about it in chapter 12, 13, 15, 17, 22. Again, it's just an ongoing development of that covenant. And again, first given to Abraham in Genesis 12, officially ratified in Genesis chapter 15. But anyway, this covenant given to Abraham is now was officially and clearly passed to Isaac. Okay, in Genesis chapter 26, not Isaac's half-brother Ishmael, the oldest of Abraham's sons, but to Isaac. So we saw that in Genesis chapter 26. And we also saw in Genesis chapter 26, we saw examples of Isaac's spiritual immaturity. Okay, what does Isaac do? He goes and lives in Gerar, and what does he tell the king there, Abimelech? Because he's afraid, he tells Abimelech that his wife is his sister. To avoid any problems for himself. I'm surprised that his wife didn't slap him a few times in all of this, but so we see just his immaturity. But then we also saw his faithfulness. If you remember just digging that well after well after well, and when he finally finds peace in the area, who does he give the credit to? It's not to his own hard work in digging all these wells. It's the credit all goes to Yahweh, to God. So again, just kind of that contrast, his immaturity as well as his faithfulness. And then chapter 26 closed in verse 34 and 35 with the sad decision of Esau to marry two heathen Hittite women, again reflecting his rejection of Yahweh as the only true and living God. And we saw the sorrow and anguish that that brought to his parents in that action. Then in chapter 27, we see the favoritism and tension which had developed in that family. It's going to culminate in chapter 27. And we saw the details of how the blessings that were first passed from Abraham to Isaac are now being passed from Isaac to Jacob. That's a key focus here in chapter 27. And again, the blessing should have passed to the oldest son. The rules of the day should have gone to Esau, humanly speaking, but God had sovereignly chosen Jacob while they were still both of the boys were still in Rebekah's womb. And in the sovereign plan of God, again, Esau had sold his birthright. So that process has begun in the blessing going to Jacob. So last week we did the first 29 verses last week, and we saw in the first four verses, we saw Isaac's plan to bless Esau. Again, Isaac wants the birthright to go to Esau because that's his favored son. And he's going to do this privately. We talked about that. He's not going to do it. Typically, the birthright blessing celebration would be done openly. He's going to do it privately, just him and his son, okay? Because he doesn't want Rebekah there. He doesn't want Jacob there saying, hey, you know, what about this or what about that? He wants to just get this done in private, pass things on to his favored son. Then in verse 5 and following, Rebekah overhears Isaac's conversation with Esau. And what does she do? She comes up with a deceptive plan, a scheme to trick Isaac into blessing Jacob instead. Okay, and she enlists Jacob's help in implementing this plan. And it kind of, you know, they're going to trick Isaac into thinking that Jacob is Esau. And they're going to do it kind of three emphases in there. The food, Rebekah's going to cook some food because Esau had gone out hunting, was going to come back, cook a meal, and him and his father were going to celebrate this birthright blessing thing. So Rebekah cooks up good food to trick Isaac, and then she puts some of Esau's clothes on Jacob to trick Isaac, and then she somehow covers Isaac's hands and smooth neck, I'm sorry, Jacob's hands and neck with goat hair to emulate Esau's hairiness. So she does all these things, and Jacob goes in to see his dad. And then that's what we see in verse 18 and following, that Rebekah's plan works to a T. Okay, Isaac is initially skeptical, but after he smells, you know, Jacob, who he thinks is Esau, after he kind of has the smell from the clothes and he has the hair on the hands and he tastes the food, he's like, okay, this really is my son Esau. And he does the blessing in verse 27, 28, and 29 in this prayerful call on God to prosper his son. You know, agriculture abundance, superiority over other peoples and nations, and domination over his brothers or relatives. And then he also calls for that curse on those who curse him, curse his son, and blessing on those who bless him. And taking us right back to that initial Abrahamic covenant in Genesis chapter 12, verse 3. So again, this acknowledging that, you know, Esau or Jacob, who he thinks is Esau, is indeed in the covenantal line. Okay, so then that's it. You know, Esau's excited, Isaac is excited, this is all going to happen. Okay, we'll pick up in verse 30 is where we left off last week. Now it happened that as soon as Isaac had finished blessing both, so then Jacob is blessed instead. Now it happened, verse 30, that as soon as Isaac had finished blessing Jacob, and Jacob had hardly gone out from the presence of Isaac, his father, that Esau, his brother, came in from his hunting. Then he also made a savory dish and brought it to his father. And he said to his father, let my father arise and eat of his son's game, that you may bless, that your soul may bless me. And Isaac, his father, said to him, who are you? And he said, I am your son, your firstborn Esau. You can kind of imagine like what's going on during this period. You know, God's perfect sovereign timing. You know, Esau comes right after Jacob leaves. Okay, he's been out hunting. And then he prepares this meal, this savory dish, this delicious food, ESV puts it, which Rebekah had already, you know, copied. And he comes into his father and he said, let's do it. And Isaac goes, you know, apprehensive question, who are you? And that would have been a scene fun to watch, like from the corner, watching down what's going on. And then verse 33. Then Isaac trembled exceedingly violently and said, "Who was he then that hunted game and brought it to me so that I ate of all of it before you came? And bless him. Indeed, he shall be blessed." So again, Isaac's in shock. He's like overwhelmed by the realization of what had just happened. And he's impacted physically. I like different translations, put a little bit different spin on this, but trembled exceedingly violently. I like that LSB. Trembled very violently, ESV puts it. Began to shake violently, the New English Translation puts it. But the key idea there is he's physically impacted. He's having a seizure almost because of what has happened. You know, his worst fear has come to pass. If you remember from last week, he was initially kind of skeptical because Jacob, who he thought was Esau, the voice was off, but then the food seemed right, the clothes and smell seemed right, you know, the hairy hand seemed right, so he went ahead and was convinced. Now he's like, no, it really was a ploy. It was a deception. And he's come to understand that. And then the blessing that that Isaac gave to who he thought was Esau, although it was really Jacob, was then legally binding. He could not undo it. And one commentator was pointing out that recent discoveries from writings from court scenes of that day that a verbal agreement was just as binding as a written agreement. So there was no undoing of this. And then also, too, you know, as you read through this, I think Isaac's probably come to terms with it. He probably already knew that Jacob is indeed his least favored son, is indeed the chosen line. And so God had overruled him and made sure the rightful son of promise, his youngest son, got the blessing. So despite Isaac's efforts to the contrary, God's will had been done. Okay, Jacob had the birthright blessing. He was the inheritance. He was the chosen line. And then he quotes, you know, there at the end of verse 33, "Indeed, he shall be blessed." You know, this is reality. This is the way it is. I like the way John MacArthur put it. Isaac remembered the Lord's word to Rebekah back in chapter 25. You know, that the older will serve the younger. He refused to withdraw the blessing, which he couldn't have anyway. But he, you know, rather than withdrawing it or trying to withdraw it, he emphatically affirmed its validity. This is the way it needs to be. You know, he's come face to face with his own disobedience. He faithfully yields to God's will and plan, and what's done, is his word here to his son Esau. So in a sense, Rebekah and Jacob win this, though they gained nothing that God would not have given them anyway. Okay, Jacob was the son of promise, the line of promise, and that would have transpired regardless of what Rebekah and Jacob did. So they got what they would have gotten anyway, but in the process, through the deception and that all of that, they laid the foundation for great misery in the family. Okay, Esau and Jacob will be enemies. The Edomites and the Israelites, their descendants, will be enemies throughout Old Testament history. So again, Jacob and Rebekah again demonstrate their lack of trust in God. If God says he's going to do it, he's going to do it. He doesn't need us to carry the mantle of deception to make it happen. Okay, he will do it. He will bring it to pass. The blessings of God are given. The blessings are given by God, not gained by deceit. So we saw Isaac's reaction. You know, he trembled exceedingly violently in verse 33. Now in verse 34, "As Esau heard the words of his father, he cried out with an exceedingly great and bitter cry and said to his father, 'Bless me, bless me, bless me also, O my father.' And he said, 'Your brother came deceitfully and has taken away your blessing.'" So again, this I like how New English Translation says he wailed loudly and bitterly. I thought about giving it a try, you know. But it's recorded, so I won't. But he just wailed loudly and bitterly and fell in this weeping heap. I mean, he knew that this was a dramatic change in his life. He thought he was inheriting all these things. that now he's not going to inherit. And he cries out in desperation for his father to bless him as well. But again, just this bitter realization of what has just transpired and the dramatic impact on his future. And John MacArthur, anguish at losing this important paternal blessing is what we have going on here. He knew that this moment in his life had changed the rest of his life. So verse 36, then he said, is he not rightly named, this is Esau talking, then he said, is he not rightly named Jacob? For he has supplanted me these two times. He took away my birthright, and behold, now he has taken away my blessing. And he said, have you not reserved a blessing for me? So again, kind of going back to when Jacob was born, given the name Jacob, it comes from the word, has the same root, it comes from the same root as the word for heel. Remember, in the time of the birth, Jacob was hanging on to Esau's heel. So they name him Jacob because of that, related to the word for heel. Well, this word supplanted comes from the same root word as well. So these are all related words, Jacob, heel, supplanted. That word supplanted is also translated cheated in ESV, taken advantage of me in NIV, and tripped me up in the New English Translation. It's kind of fun to see how some different translations phrase these things. But the key idea is he cheated me. I like the ESV. You know, he supplanted me. He cheated me. You know, but I think that Esau's forgetting a few things. You know, he's hypocritically sees himself as a totally innocent victim here. Okay, and he's not. Okay, he shifts the total blame to Jacob is what he's doing here. And he ignores his own culpability in this family debacle. Okay, Hebrews chapter 12, and we've been there before because it talks about Esau, that he's a godless person. Then it goes on in verse 17 in Hebrews chapter 12, for you know that even afterwards, when he, Esau, desired to inherit the blessing, he was rejected, for he found no place for repentance, though sought for it with tears. Okay, he's crying and he's moaning and he's, but over what? Over what he lost. It's all a personal focused thing. Has nothing to do with the will of God. He'd care less about that because he doesn't believe in God. He's a wicked, godless man, we're told very clearly. But it's all about him and what he wants. And God has trumped his desire. So again, Jacob legally acquired the birthright through bartering with Esau back in chapter 25. Now, Jacob maybe, you know, manipulated Esau some, but Esau legally forfeited the birthright. Okay, that happened back in chapter, was it 25? Yeah, I think so. Yeah, Genesis chapter 25. Esau legally forfeited it, and that was really the beginning of the end for Esau. He probably just didn't realize the gravity of what he had done, but this was a legal transaction. But while Jacob legally acquired the birthright, Jacob deceptively acquired the final blessing through fraud and a lie. Okay, so Jacob is guilty of some things in here, but it's not all Jacob's fault. Esau, again, was culpable in this process. And then the birthright and the patriarchal blessing overlap, but they're also distinct. Okay, the birthright is the inheritance that goes typically to the oldest son upon the father's death, includes the double portion and the future clan leadership. Okay, again, this was prophetically reversed by God in his prophecy to Rebekah back in chapter 25. But it's this birthright is officially bestowed by a blessing from the father before his death. So that would be the process. You know, you're kind of legally inheriting the birthright, and then you're blessed by your father. That's kind of like the final proof of, you know, final seal of approval on this. So, but while the birthright belonged to the oldest son, anyone could receive a blessing in the time, at that time. So you might have multiple children, you know, your oldest son would get that birthright blessing. You know, here it is, I'm on my deathbed, I'm ready to go, here it is. But the other children could receive blessings as well. So, and when we get to chapter 49, we'll see that Jacob is going to bless all 12 of his sons. You know, a prophetic pronouncement. Blessing, blessing didn't necessarily include material things, but it was a prophetic pronouncement about the future and course of your children. So not only did Esau lose his birthright, but he also lost the blessing that he was hoping for. Okay, verse 37. But Isaac answered and said to Esau, "Behold, I have made him your master, and all his fellow brothers I have given to him as servants, and with grain and new wine I have sustained him. Now as for you then, what can I do, my son?" And Esau said to his father, Do you have only one blessing, my father? Bless me, even me also, O my father." So Esau lifted his voice and wept. So again, Isaac kind of overviews the content of the blessing he gave to Jacob. It's irrevocable. That word brothers is also translated relatives. It's that way in NASB. There's only Jacob and Esau are the only two brothers at this time. So yeah.
The older son got a double portion.
Yeah.
But he had also the responsibility to take care of his mother and his parents.
Yes, there were other responsibilities that passed on with that. Yep. Thank you for adding that. So yeah, he's going to be the head of the clan when Isaac dies. He's been blessed with abundant material provision. There's no going back. There's no undoing these things. And again, Esau now realizes the futility of his position, but he begs his father for some type of blessing to be given to him before Isaac's seemingly imminent death. We know from chapter verse 2, and we'll see it again in verse 41, that everybody expects Isaac to, like, he's on his deathbed. He's at the end, but he lives for another, I think it's 43 years. So his life is going to extend on. And then in verse 39 and 40, Isaac's going to respond with a blessing, a prophetic pronouncement. But it sounds more like a curse than like a good thing from Esau's perspective. So verse 39. Then Isaac his father answered and said to him, "Behold, away from the fatness of the earth shall be your habitation, and away from the dew of heaven from above. By your sword you shall live, and your brother you shall serve. But it shall be when you become restless that you will break his yoke from your neck." So again, this prophetic pronouncement about Esau's future. You're going to live away from the fatness of the earth, and NASB translates fatness as fertility. So the idea here is you're not going to be blessed. Okay, that's the key idea here. And then the Edomites, Esau's descendants, would live in a land less fertile and productive than Canaan. And that's what happens. Edom is going to be south and east of where Canaan is, in a much more arid, less fertile area. Now, there is an alternate interpretation for this. That isn't quite so bad for Esau. And if you have a New King James or some of the older translations, King James, don't say away from the fatness of the earth and away from the dew of heaven above, but they say your dwelling shall be of the fatness of the earth. So kind of a different idea. You might participate in some of the same blessings, but Jacob's got most of it, but you're going to participate in it. You're going to be of the fatness of the earth and of the dew of heaven above. And then some translate that word, so we got away from, is how NASB, LSB, ESV, NIV all say away from. Some of the translations say of, and then some translators think that word away from shouldn't really be away from or of, but it's by. So there's some differences of opinion in this. I think the best way to translate this, though, is, and by far the most accepted one, is that this is almost a curse. He's going to be away from it. Okay, he's not going to have the prosperity that his brother has. And not only that, it goes on, you're going to live by the sword. And that really encapsulates the history of the Edomites. I mean, it's a very, very sad history, ongoing struggle and hostility and warfare. And they are conquered. I believe it's David finally conquers the Edomites and subjugates them. But then they do. You know, there's kind of an end here. At the end of verse 40, it shall be when you become restless that you will break his yoke from your back. So it kind of ends with a little glimmer of hope, and that is what happens with the Edomites. They do, after being conquered and subjugated by David and ruled by the Jews for over a century, that then they do rebel and regain their freedom. So again, this is a prophecy looking forward to a reality that actually unfolds as you study through the Old Testament. I didn't have enough time to go in and look at the history of Edom and how that all unfolded. But again, warfare, subjugation, but eventually regaining their independence. So this prophecy is all fulfilled in history, as recorded in the Old Testament. Okay, so verse 41. So Esau bore a grudge against Jacob because of the blessing with which his father had blessed him. And Esau said in his heart, "The days of mourning for my father are near." Again, they think Isaac's going to die right away. "Then I will kill my brother Jacob." So that bore a grudge is also translated hated. He hated with burning passion this brother of his. And you know, as a result of the deception that occurred and how things have unfolded, he's intent on murdering Jacob, on getting rid of him. You know, he couldn't thought, I like how I was reading some notes from Mike Voss, who we all know and love. But he said, Esau couldn't stand the thought of Jacob, his mama's boy brother, having dominion over him. Kind of remember that Jacob liked to dwell in the tents and cook and that kind of stuff, and Esau liked to hunt. You know, and Esau just couldn't stand that. Mama's boy won. That's impossible. It can't happen. But he's going to respectfully wait until his father's death before he murders his brother. Again, yeah, in Genesis chapter 35, verse 28, we find out that Isaac dies at 180, which again is 43 years or so from where we're at here. Again, Isaac will end up being the oldest of all the patriarchs. Remember, Abraham died at 175. Isaac's going to die at 180, and then all the subsequent patriarchs die sooner than that. Okay, verse 42. Then the words of her elder son Esau were told to Rebekah. So she sent and called her younger son Jacob and said to him, "Behold, your brother Esau is consoling himself concerning you by planning to kill you. So now, my son, listen to my voice and arise, flee to Haran, to my brother Laban. Stay with him a few days until your brother's wrath subsides, until your brother's anger against you subsides and he forgets what you did to him. Then I will send and get you from there. Why should I be bereaved of you both in one day?" So here Rebekah hears that Esau is out for revenge. Doesn't really say who told her. You know, was it Isaac or one of the servants that maybe overheard things? But Jacob is in imminent danger of being killed by his angry brother. I like in verse 45 where she says, "For what you did to him." Well, she kind of conveniently forgets that this was really all her idea, if you remember the story. This was all Rebekah's idea on how to have Jacob deceive Isaac. But, you know, she conceived the plan, then she really ordered, instructed her son to follow the plan. So she played a role in this as well. But now Rebekah, you know, that scheming mother, comes up with another plan to save her son. And, you know, flee to Haran and stay with Uncle Laban. Remember, we read about Laban back in chapter, well, he was kind of a key guy back in Genesis chapter 24. And we're going to talk a lot about Laban in the future as well. He becomes a key character here in Jacob's life. But again, that's 500 plus miles away to get back up into Mesopotamia to Haran. So it's, you know, maybe up to a month of travel, depending on the weather and those kinds of things. So it's not just a little bit of a journey. It's a big journey. And then stay there a few days. Okay, well, it's like just for, I think some translations say a while or for a little while. You're going to be there for a short period of time is the idea. And again, Rebekah's hoping that Esau's anger will subside, and so then she can bring Jacob back safely. The plan backfires, because how long does Jacob end up in Mesopotamia? 20 years. It's not a few days. It's not a little while. It's 2 decades. Okay, he's going to be there for a long time. And he's not going to ever see his mother again. Okay, that's what happens here. Again, part of the consequences of what they've done. He's not going to see his beloved mother again. Again, it's kind of that reaping what you sow. They you know, pursuing God's will, God's plan, but doing it in a deceptive way. You know, that doesn't work. We're required to do things in an upright, godly fashion. When we're pursuing God's will, to do it in an unright fashion leads to consequences that none of us want. And this is their consequence. Rebekah will never get to see her son again or any of her grandchildren from that son. So the end of verse 45, why should I be bereaved of you both in one day, probably is referring to the idea of the blood revenge. That was a practice of the day where an elder relative, you know, in the event of a murder or a death, the nearest elder relative would be obligated to avenge the murder by tracking down and executing the perpetrator of the crime. So she was like, you know, you killed Jacob, and then Esau is going to be hunted down by the blood avenger and killed as well. And again, that was the custom and practice of the day. In the Mosaic law, that practice isn't ended, but it is regulated and restricted in the law of Moses. We have things like the sanctuary cities and some of those types of instructions that then kind of rein that in. You know, you have to prove guilt and those types of things. Okay, so then in verse 46, then Rebekah said to Isaac, I am tired of living because of the daughters of Heth. So Rebekah and Isaac are talking now. If Jacob takes a wife from the daughters of Heth, like these from the daughters of the land, what good will my life be to me? So again, Rebekah, if you remember back at the end of chapter 26, you know, Esau, verse 34, Esau was 40 years old, and he took as a wife Judith, the daughter of Beeri, the Hittite, and also Basemath, the daughter of Elon, the Hittite. So again, he marries local, godless, heathen wives. And then at the end, in that last verse in chapter 26, and they brought bitterness to Isaac and Rebekah. I mean, it was a very, very sad situation, these marriages. And Rebekah doesn't want the same thing to befall Jacob. Get him out of here. Let's get him to Mesopotamia so he can find somebody in the family that you know, calls upon the name of Yahweh. So she wants to get him out of there. And that word Heth, Heth is the ancestral patriarch of the local Hittites. So back in the previous chapter, it's talking about Hittites. Now we're talking about Heth. It'd be the same thing, okay? Some people are a little harsh on Rebekah here. They say that she's really deceiving her husband again. And, you know, she expresses this disgust with the Hittite daughters because she wants to get Jacob to flee for his safety. She's not so worried about the influence of the godless daughters. She's just more worried about his safety and wants to get him out of there. And so kind of this negative view on Rebekah. But I think it's better. This was a heartfelt desire, Rebekah. She wanted her son's safety. Yes, we got to get him out of here to keep him safe. But she also genuinely did not want him to marry into that local system. Again, I think it's real clear on that at the end of the previous chapter. So anyway, regardless of motive, Rebekah secured Isaac's agreement to her plan. And we'll see that when we get into chapter 28, verse 1. So Jacob would travel to Mesopotamia. He's going to find a wife for himself, more than one, it'll end up being, from among his mother's family, and avoid the tragic mistake of his brother. And again, he will be in a place of safety while Esau cools off, his 20-year cooling off period, rather than a few days. So we'll go ahead and stop there. Next week, chapter 28, we begin the adventures of Jacob, which will run through chapter 36. And again, it includes 20 years in Mesopotamia, where he marries and fathers 11 of his 12 children. So any questions or comments on anything? Norm.
When Israel's going through to go to the promised land on the way down?
Yeah.
Esau doesn't let him through.
Right. The Edomites are hostile when Moses is leading the children of Israel out of Egypt. He doesn't let the Edomites do not let them go to the promised land. There's multiple, I think there were a dozen or more instances where Edomites' hostility towards Israel is talked about in the Old Testament. It's just one of those truisms. You know, the Edomites and the Israelites hated each other.
They wouldn't let them drink their water.
Yeah, they're very, very unkind to them. So, okay, good question. Anything else? Yeah, Denny.
Just real quick, too. It says Rebekah did tell Jacob, that curse be upon me if anything happens. So that word of mouth, you know, that's a real deal, that Rebecca would have borne that. And it kind of influenced Jacob, okay, let's go on with her. But still,
yeah.
It was a neutral thing.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely a mutual thing. And my thought was, I was reading this, I don't like to speculate too much, but my thought is, why didn't Rebecca go to Esau and say, I'm the one who did it, kill me? It's like, she didn't do that. So, yeah, so that sullies her character just a tad bit there. So, anything else? Good questions. Thank you. I appreciate that.
I read the other day that Esau moved to a land that was red.
So
he was red himself.
You're right. Yeah, that's that red and or Esau and red and Edom. Those things all kind of tie together. So, okay, let's go ahead and close in prayer. Dear Father, again, we want to just praise you and thank you so much for this time together, just for the privilege it is to worship together as we look into your word and discern its truth. We just thank you, Father, for the testimony, the record of the history of the patriarchs, and just how it all points to, ultimately, Father, the birth of Jesus Christ. We just ask you, Father, to help us to grow in our faith as we study your word. We just pray, Father, for the sermon to follow, again, that we would be alert and attentive to your word. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.